Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Philosophy with Dr. McDonald. In this episode, I'll be reading and discussing the section The Voluntary Beggar in Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. So let's get started. The Voluntary Beggar. When Zarathustra had left the ugliest man, he felt chilled and alone, for he had absorbed much coldness and loneliness, to such an extent that even his limbs had grown colder. But he climbed on, up hill, down dale, past green pastures, but also over wild stony courses where no doubt an impatient brook had formerly made its bed. Then all at once he grew warmer and more cheerful. "What has happened to me?" he asked himself. "Something warm and living refreshes me. It must be nearby. Already I am less alone. Unknown companions and brothers circle about me. Their warm breath touches my soul." But when he peered about him and sought the comforters of his loneliness, behold, they were cows standing together on a hillock. It was their nearness and odor that had warmed his heart. These cows, however, seemed to be listening eagerly to a speaker and paid no heed to him who approached. And when Zarathustra was quite near them, he clearly heard a human voice speaking from out the midst of the cows. And apparently, they had all turned their head towards the speaker. Then Zarathustra eagerly sprang up the hillock and pulled the animals away, for he feared that someone had had an accident, which the sympathy of cows could hardly remedy. But in this he was deceived, for behold, there on the ground sat a man who appeared to be persuading the animals to have no fear of him, a peaceable man and mountain sermonizer, out of whose eyes goodness itself preached. "What do you seek here?" cried Zarathustra in surprise. "What do I seek here?" he answered. "The same as you seek, you peace-breaker. That is, happiness on earth. To that end, however, I may learn from these cows, for let me tell you, I have already been talking to them half a morning, and they were just about to reply to me. Why do you disturb them? If we do not alter and become cows, we shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. For there is one thing that we should learn from them, rumination. And truly, if a man should gain the whole world and not learn this one thing, rumination, what would it profit him? He would not be free from his great affliction. His great affliction that, however, is today called disgust. Who today has not his heart, mouth, and eyes filled with disgust? You too, you too. But regard these cows." So then we have Zarathustra again walk his way through nature, up hills, and having this time been shaken with his meeting with the sinister man or the murderer of God in the last section, which was called The Ugliest Man. And then, as he's going along his way, he is suddenly made more cheerful by the aroma, it says, of cows who are all sort of standing together. And he's suddenly taken aback because he thinks suddenly all the animals are gathered around someone who is injured. And so he sort of shoves aside all the animals. And now we have the next character that Zarathustra is going to talk to. And that is the mountain sermonizer. Or let's just call him Mountain Man for sure. And Zarathustra's sort of taken by surprise. He says, "What do you seek here?" And then the reply comes back, "The same as you seek, you peace breaker. That is, happiness on Earth? And where is he going to learn this idea of happiness from? Is from cows. And then we have that line, if we do not all earn become as cows, we shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. For there is one thing we should learn from them, rumination. And the word itself, ruminate, means to chew. And so it's what cows do, of course, when they're chewing upon grass. And it also means to think deeply upon something, when you're chewing upon a subject, but having a great big deep think about it. And so it's sort of playing off this double meaning of both the cows themselves chewing upon the grass, but also the idea of thinking more deeply upon things. And so that's one of the ways in which we have this initial part come out here, that what we must do is to think deeply upon things. Why is that the case? Because he says that one of the great afflictions for today is called disgust. And then he says the line, who today has not his heart, mouth, and eyes filled with disgust? You too, you too. But regard these cows. And that's about as much it goes into for this whole idea of disgust. And so we get those two things that come out of this initial first part here. One to do with, what do you seek? Happiness. How do I gain happiness? We have to chew upon things, think deeply, like cows. And what is the benefit of that is to be free from disgust, because cows themselves cannot have any disgust whatsoever, because they just quite happily chew the grass and go about their lives. And so we have this whole nice relation then into part four and where we're up to now. After the conversation with the sinister man, we're sort of left with that whole, well, how are we meant to overcome this situation where it's been established in each given instance that any attempt at trying to find a foundation, be it one that was divine, we can no longer go to that because God is dead. God no longer holds the same significance in any way, shape, or form for our knowledge. And so, therefore, we have to move towards a more scientific basis. But then also, for the last section, we said, well, that also can't be based upon man or humanity in the sense of all those problematic qualities that came out of it, of being selfish, egotistical, solely based on their own aspirations. And hence why you had that lovely line at the end of the last section, man is something that should be overcome, and we're going to move eventually towards that idea of the overman, and how exactly do you overcome man? So, continuing on into all this then, we have this whole idea about humanity and the problems with society at the same time. And we have this highlighted with the problem of disgust in this section. And what's quite interesting that I thought was a good relation into this for this section is of this whole modern phenomenon, as they call it, of cancel culture, where someone is offended, and because they're offended, they immediately think it's harmful and wrong and should be immediately disposed of and gotten rid of. And so we have that nice part there of saying, well, absolutely everything today has heart, mouth, and eyes filled with disgust. You too. But regard these cows. And it's not suddenly just to therefore say, what should somebody who's offended be more like a cow? It's that whole point about thinking more deeply upon the whole situation in the first place and asking all those deeper questions. Is it correct that I'm offended? Does that mean that I'm right and always right if I'm offended by whatever it is? And one of the main targets that comes up quite frequently as well is comedic jokes and comedians, where they would tell a joke and someone would be offended by that joke. And of course, there's then that whole relation into it that we can see, well, people would be filled with disgust, hatred, want to get rid of and suppress that comedian because it doesn't fit in with their own agenda of trying to make everything nice and how exactly that person would see everything and see the world. But that's also the point, is that there's an irony to all that because it's a joke in the first place. It's not something that's meant to be taken seriously. So you're taking seriously something that itself is not meant to be taken seriously. And there's a fantastic line as well when Nietzsche talks about Socrates. Socrates, he said, was a buffoon that got himself taken seriously. What happens when that happens? And it's that whole line there as well of, well, you have someone who, in the given instance of Socrates, doesn't have any agenda or basis for his arguments, because Socrates' main line of argument is, I know nothing. And then along comes Plato, who idolizes and loves his teacher of Socrates. But then you exactly start to see what Nietzsche's getting at. Through that idolization that Plato has of Socrates, then the man who was a buffoon gets taken seriously. Then the man who was a buffoon suddenly then starts to have an agenda and then starts to have a bias. And so it's quite interesting when we can relate that specific point the mountain man makes. One of the great afflictions we have today is disgust, is precisely something that is still very much relevant within contemporary society, that there's so much an outpouring of disgust with things and offense and wanting to be offended by things. And it goes back into that rumination point of, well, we should think more deeply upon subjects and even question whether it is right to go down such an extremely harsh route in the first place. Because then, of course, if you go down that route, then you go into the whole idea in the very extremes of book burnings and limiting exactly who can say what, and only allowing certain people with viewpoints that are okay and acceptable because it adheres to a specific ideology. And it all limits it all down, it makes it narrower and narrower, and before you know it, you end up in a situation very much like V for Vendetta, where everything is controlled, or a situation like a totalitarian state, where everything is suppressed, everything is controlled because it doesn't fit in within the state ideology. And so let's continue on then with the mountain man. Thus spoke the mountain sermonizer, and then turned his glance upon Zarathustra, for up to then it had rested lovingly upon the cows. At that, however, he changed. "Who is that I am speaking with?" he cried, startled, and jumped up from the ground. "This is the man without disgust. This is Zarathustra himself, the overcomer of the great disgust. This is the eye, this is the mouth, This is the heart of Zarathustra himself. And as he spoke, thus he kissed the hands of him to whom he spoke with overflowing eyes, and behaved like someone to whom a valuable gift and jewel has unexpectedly fallen from heaven. The cows, however, looked on and were amazed. "Do not speak of me, you strange, friendly man," said Zarathustra, straining his affection. "First speak to me of yourself. Are you not the voluntary beggar who once threw away great riches, who was ashamed of his riches and of the rich, and fled to the poor that he might give them his abundance and his heart? But they received him not." "But they received me not," said the voluntary beggar. "You know that. So at last I went to the animals and to these cows." "Then you learned," Zarathustra interrupted the speaker, "how it is harder to give well than to take well. And to give well is an art, and the ultimate, subtlest master art of kindness." "These days especially," answered the voluntary beggar, "for today everything base has become rebellious and reserved, and in its own way haughty. That is, in the mob's way. For the hour has come, you know it, for the great, evil, protracted, slow rebellion of the mob and the slaves. It grows and grows. Now all benevolence and petty giving provokes the base, and let the overrich be on their guard. Whoever today lets drops fall like a big-bellied bottle out of a too narrow neck. People like to break the necks of such bottles today. Lustful greed, bitter envy, sour vindictiveness, mob pride. All this threw itself in my face. It is no longer true that the poor are blessed. The kingdom of heaven, however, is with the cows. And why is it not with the rich?" asked Zarathustra, tempting him as he restrained the cows, which were sniffing familiarly at the man of peace. "Why do you tempt me?" answered the latter. "You yourself know better even than I, for what drove me to the poorest, O Zarathustra, was it not disgust with our richest? Disgust with those punished by riches who glean advantage from all kinds of sweepings with cold eyes, rank thoughts. Disgust with this rabble that stinks to heaven. Disgust with this gilded, debased mob whose fathers were pickpockets or carrion birds or ragmen with complaint. Lustful, forgetful wives, for they are all of them not far from whores. Mob above, mob below, what are poor and rich today? I have unlearned this distinction. Then I fled away, far away, and even farther, until I came to these cows." Thus spoke the man of peace, and himself snorted and perspired as he spoke, so that the cows were again amazed. Zarathustra, however, looked him in the face with a smile all the while he was speaking so sternly, and then silently shook his head. "You do violence to yourself, mountain sermonizer, when you use such stern words. Neither your mouth nor your eyes were made for such sternness, nor your stomach either, as I think that opposes all such raging and hating and over-frothing. Your stomach wants gentler things. You are no butcher. On the contrary, you seem to me a man of plants and roots. Perhaps you grind corn, but you are certainly disinclined to fleshy pleasures and love honey." "You have divined me well," answered the voluntary beggar, with lightened heart. "I love honey, I also grind corn, for I have sought what tastes well and produces sweet breath. also what takes a long time, a day's work and a day's chewing for gentle idlers and sluggards. To be sure, these cows have attained the greatest proficiency in it. They have devised rumination and lying in the sun, and they abstain from all heavy thoughts that inflate the heart. Very well, said Zarathustra, you shall see my animals too, my eagle and my serpent. There is not their like on earth today. Behold, yonder leads the way to my cave. Be its guest tonight, and speak with my animals of the happiness of animals. Until I return home myself, for now a cry of distress calls me hurriedly away from you. You will find new honey, too, at my cave, golden honey in the comb, cold as ice. Eat it, but now straightway take leave of your cows, you strange, friendly man. Although it may be hard for you, for they are your warmest friends and teachers. Except one whom I love more, answered the voluntary beggar. You yourself are good, and even better than a cow, O Zarathustra. Away, away with you, you arrant flatterer, cried Zarathustra mischievously. Why do you spoil me with such praise and honey of flattery? Away, away from me. He cried again and swung his stick at the affectionate beggar. He, however, ran nimbly away. And so we continue on with the discussion between Zarathustra and the Mountain Man. And we finally get the explanation for why this section is called the Voluntary Beggar, because this Mountain Man who's went to go and learn from cows was in fact rich and gave up all his wealth in order to give it to the poor. But there was a snag, as they say, that they didn't receive him well. That is to say, the people didn't think very highly of this man for having given up his wealth. And it is quite a strange action itself, because it's not explained exactly who he's giving this money to. Is it a charity, or is it just a random set of individuals? However, we do get quite an interesting explanation here about the reasons for why he's went to the cows in the first place, because he's seen the mob as being something that is lustful in their greed and having bitter envy, sour vindictiveness, and mob pride. So various different interests and qualities all coming out there. And let's come back to this in a little moment, because there's a really interesting relation in this whole idea here of someone giving up their wealth and the whole idea that the poor are no longer blessed, because we have that nice relation into the Bible, and there's a nice article precisely on the lines of blessed are the poor. What does this mean? From the National Catholic Reporter, and it's by Thomas Grumbleton. So I'm just going to choose specific little parts out here that's going to help us understand the theological background for this section and what it's saying, and then what exactly is happening with what Nietzsche wants it to do. So, as the article says then, Mark tells us that just as Christ was setting out on a journey again, a man ran up to him, knelt before him, and asked, "Good master, what must I do to have an eternal life?" Jesus answered, "Why do you call me good? Nobody's good but God alone." But you know the commandments: do not kill, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not bear false witness, do not cheat, honor your father and mother. And the man replied, I have obeyed all these commandments since my childhood. Then Jesus looked steadily at him and loved him, and he said, for you one thing is lacking. Go sell what you have, give the money to the poor, then come and follow me. On hearing these words, the man's face fell, and he went away sorrowful, for he was a man of great wealth. So why do we have this relation into the poor? And it continues on here. In Luke's gospel, it just says, blessed are the poor. And sometimes people think, well, Matthew modified that. Poor in spirit, that takes a little bit of the edge off of it. But it really doesn't. It simply helps us to realize that when Jesus is talking about blessed are the poor, he's talking more about an attitude, a way of knowing one's need for God, which is a disposition of the heart and not simply economic deprivation. Poor in spirit means that we understand a profound truth about ourselves, the truth that none of us is responsible for our own existence and our own continuance of existence. Poor in spirit means we understand our need for God and who God is and who we are. Poor in spirit means we understand that without God and God's gift to us of existence, of life, that we would not be. God has loved us into being. God has loved all of creation into being, and it's only God's love that sustains all creation as it continues to evolve and develop in each one of us, God's continuing love. So that gives us a nice understanding of the theological side of this whole giving away wealth to the poor because of that whole relation to God and understanding the nature of God, God's love, and so on. However, with the Nietzsche then, we have this removal of God because people have come to learn and understand that God is dead. So what happens in this instance to people once they accept that God is dead? In fact, we have then no longer this whole idea of being poor in spirit has then a closeness and relationship to God, but rather we have the poor themselves then have this whole reversal of the whole situation where they then won wealth and power and even possibly fame in the midst of all that, because we go back to those points that were made. What is the qualities that we have? Greed, envy, vindictiveness, and mob pride. So precisely wanting greed in relation to wealth, envious of other people, vindictiveness and spiteful against other people, and that whole mob pride of what we think is right and everybody else is wrong. And so no positive qualities really whatsoever that you come out with. And then, following on from this, we have then Zarathustra say, well, if not with the poor, then why not with the rich? And if all the problems that are highlighted are with the poor, then what about the opposite of that? And then we have the reply from the mountain man. It's precisely disgust with our riches that drove me to get rid of my wealth in the first place. And then it goes through the various different qualities there, as it says, disgust with those punished by riches who glean advantage from all kinds of sweepings with cold eyes, rank thoughts, disgust with this rabble that stinks to heaven, disgust with this gilded, debased mob whose fathers were pickpockets or carrion birds or ragmen with complaint. lustful, forgetful wives, for they are all of them not far from whores. So it's that whole mentality you can have there from the psychology of the rich, as the mountain man sees it, is the problems that they look precisely down upon those who don't have money, and precisely have those cold eyes, rank thoughts with them, and precisely find the rabble disgusting. So we have this sort of caricature of the typical sort of fat cat character there. Precisely that individual that's always portrayed as wearing a top hat, smoking a cigar, and having on a tuxedo, looking down upon everyone else who's not wealthy. And then there's the irony to this that then comes in directly after this to say, well, all their background for how they accumulated wealth in the first place was through underhanded means, because their fathers were the pickpockets or carrion birds and so forth. So you have that whole idea there. It's that selfish, egotistical moves for acquiring wealth, and that sort of carrion birds picking precisely it, all the leftovers that's been there. And then rounding off, it says about the promiscuity of their wives. So we have then both sides of the problems with the psychologies of the poor and then of the rich, where we have with the poor that whole problem of envy, greed, vindictiveness, mob pride. And then on the other hand, we have precisely with the rich the problems of looking down upon other people who don't have wealth and thinking that people who are not wealthy are just basically not worth their time. And then we have Zarathustra come in. And then Zarathustra says to the man, you're not really suited for using such stern words. You want gentler things. Perhaps you grind corn and love honey. That basically the man wants the simpler pleasures out of life, and that he has also found that joy in simplicity in a way. And we have this nice sort of relation into Epicureanism at the same time, where there is a misunderstanding of Epicureanism, where you would have the philosophy of Epicurus is very much joy in excess, where you would have, of course, the misunderstanding would be to go enjoy life to the fullest, and therefore when you go to eat, go eat at a buffet every single time. Somehow that misunderstanding's come to characterize Epicureanism. However, it means precisely the opposite of that, to enjoy the very simplest of things and to have your lifestyle based upon only what is natural and necessary is what Epicurus would argue for, away from anything that's unnecessary. And what's seen as unnecessary is things to do with any accumulation of fame or power whatsoever, because the argument there is you don't need any more rooms than is necessary in a house, so therefore a mansion's out the window. And also, for what's necessary as well, goes down to your diet. You don't need meat whatsoever. You don't need fish whatsoever. So Epicureanism itself is sort of one of the first vegetarian diets as well that's argued for. It's something that's based upon only what's natural and necessary to us. So we have that sort of nice Epicurean lifestyle sort of choice made by the mountain man there. And then it rounds off, as it has been doing in the other sections, in part four, with Zarathustra inviting the mountain man to come up to his cave, and there he can talk to his animals. And of course, by this point, it's quite the hip-happening place for his cave, because we have all the other characters from the previous sections there at the same time. And then it rounds off with a final little part about, "There's one thing I love more than cows," said the mountain man. "You yourself are good and even better than a cow, O Zarathustra." And then Zarathustra's, "Oh, away, away from me." And so we have then it rounding off on this sort of point where you have the mountain man kind of be like the leech man, in the sense of wanting to try and find the perfect lifestyle choice for them. And of course, one of the big problems of this whole section is, what life would it be like to more or less have a life like a cow? Would that actually be something that's pleasant, to just be abstained from all heavy thoughts and to just sit there and ruminate and chew? And then precisely we have that whole relation into how it rounds off. "I've found something better than a cow. Zarathustra, you're better than a cow." And then Zarathustra is like, "Oh no, stop flattering me." But that's the whole sort of irony to this at the same time, is that he wants for the mountain man to have this sort of pleasant life, but it's very much so in a complete idealistic state, sort of free from any worries whatsoever. But that's sort of the whole point, is that there is the whole point of realistic whole relation of society at the same time. And we have all those problems that's been illustrated with herd mentality, and now the whole developing out more psychological problems that's happened within society in this section. However, all that is what makes up life, arguably, and it cracks the nice idealistic picture of having this relationship with nature, and that all of what the man wants is for ultimately just to have this idealistic perfect existence. And, "Oh, Zarathustra, you sound great, I think I'll listen to you." And then isn't he kind of breaking his own point about ruminating in the first place by flattering Zarathustra there? Shouldn't he ruminate a little more? And then he wouldn't need Zarathustra. So that about wraps up this episode. And it's been quite an interesting discussion, where we've had this whole psychology as well as relation into the whole ideas of rich and poor that's come out, and that relation into the theology and theological side of blessed be the poor, with the whole idea now that God is dead. We can no longer have that relationship where the poor are in this sort of privileged state because they don't have the wealth in the first place, and so they have that closer relationship to God. With the removal of God, then we have the poor precisely lusting after wealth and power, and so then we say, well, and at the same time, with the rich and the wealthy, it's been stated here that, as the mountain man has said, they look down upon the poor. So there's both sides of the problem there, with neither side to be ultimately privileged over the other. And then it rounds off with that whole discussion, very Epicurean in style, and then the mountain man flattering Zarathustra at the end. In the next episode, we'll be continuing on through part four into the next section called The Shadow. Many thanks for listening to the episode. I hope you enjoyed my discussion of the section The Voluntary Beggar in Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Feel free to check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/dissectingphilosophy. Feel free to tip me a coffee at ko-fi.com/dissectingphilosophy. Drop me an email at my address, dissectingphilosophy@gmail.com. And lastly, I can be found on Twitter at IAmARubberMan. Many thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time.